This is going great. You're very good at this. Welcome, everyone, to the Impact, a sustainable CT podcast for your edification, your enlightenment, and your entertainment, too. I'm Jim Hunt, Communications Manager at Sustainable CT, so if you're looking for someone to blame for this podcast, well, you can blame me. But remember, this is never a one-way conversation. We always want to hear from you for our edification and enlightenment. Drop us a note, won't you, to info@sustainablect.org. The Impact is brought to you in part by our good friends at the Common Sense Fund. The Common Sense Fund supports environmental change through education, policy initiatives, promotion of carbon-free energy sources, and stewardship of our natural resources. The fund promotes action both on the environment and in the arts that is practical, creative, and addresses social needs, and we are oh so glad they do. Sustainable CT is independently funded. We don't receive support from any level of government or from a university, not even from a magical rainbow unicorn money tree. No, sir, but you can be a Sustainable CT sponsor. Find out how at sustainablect.org. I have two delightful guests today, Inez Ortiz and Dorothy Pizak. They both just recently joined Sustainable CT as program assistants, and I wanted to take this opportunity to get to know them a little better and what their aspirations are here at Sustainable CT and in the wider world, for that matter. Inez graduated from Southern Connecticut State University in 2023 with a bachelor's degree in science, majoring in environmental systems and sustainability science with a concentration in environmental policy. During her time at SCSU, Inez conducted research on the effectiveness of carbon pricing policies in reducing international greenhouse gas emissions. She's also interned at the Connecticut Department of Environmental Protection, of Energy Environmental Protection. Excuse me, we affectionately refer to it as DEEP. Dorothy graduated from the University of Connecticut with a bachelor's degree in ecology and evolutionary biology, I knew I'd get that right, and psychological sciences. During her time at UConn, she served as president of the Avery Point Echo Husky Club and conducted a sustainability review of the Avery Point campus. She's worked and volunteered in numerous communities, including as a site lead at an education nonprofit in Washington, D.C., and as an AmeriCorps volunteer. She is an avid hiker and recently completed a thru-hike of the Appalachian Trail. Very cool, which I find fascinating, having spent a good deal of time and miles on the AT myself over the years. Inez, let's start with you. Tell me a little bit more about yourself, and most particularly, how did you become interested in sustainability issues?
Yeah, so I like the very nice bio you gave me. I just graduated from Southern not that long ago, and I've always really just had a very deep passion for sustainability. Even before I knew what it was, I always thought the environment and natural wildlife was just so important. And I always saw it a little as unfair of how us humans get to live and what we do to the natural environment. So I've always just had a passion to figure out a way where we can balance that, where we're not taking too much and we're not putting too much out there. And then I got to college and this crazy word sustainability I learned about, and I was like, wow, that is the word I've been looking for forever. So it was pretty easy to decision to make once I learned about sustainability, and yeah, it led me here.
You know, what's interesting about that is when I was growing up, none of this was discussed. It wasn't an issue, right? So all of my formative years, I didn't really learn about ecology. That's what we used to call it. Ecology and environmentalism until I went to college. But my kids and you, more or less the same generation as my kids, my son's 19, grew up in this milieu, right? That it's always been a part of their lives. The whole notion of a threatened planet and sustainability and what we need to do to combat climate change is part of their DNA, I had to learn about it. And you did not. Now, I'm not saying you're better off for that. I think it's kind of a scary thing when you're a kid to have this tossed at you. The planet's burning and we're killing it. At the same time, though, you learn to, I don't know, the whole language and idea and concept of trying to have a greener world and a livable planet is baked in, if you will, terrible turn of phrase, baked into who you are as a person, where it was not for my generation, where we've had to come to it late. So it's interesting how the two of you may have come to this whole notion of sustainability. How about you, Dorothy? What was your entrance to sustainability?
Yeah, so I grew up on a farm, so I feel like I've always kind of been, and my dad is pretty active on the conservation commission in our town, so sustainability was sort of a thing that was introduced at a young age and has always kind of been a part of the conversations in my house. So I guess that's sort of where it started. And then just as I got older, I enjoyed spending more and more time outside, and more and more of my hobbies centered around being outside. And it's just always been an integral part of my life. Then when I was in high school, I took an AP environmental science class. That was a big learning opportunity for me, and seeing especially sustainability, such a broad term and encompasses so many different things. So that was my first like academic introduction to sustainability. And then eventually when I went to college, I knew I wanted to study something that centered around the environment. I ended up doing more of a research science-based approach, but I also think my psychology major kind of plays into that as well, just because there is so much, you know, human relations that go into sustainability. So yeah, that's my story.
Well, that's interesting. So let me ask either of you, did there come a time, I don't know, when you became a rebellious teenager or whatever, sometime in your formative years, where you looked at the generation that came before you and got angry? Like, how could you do this? Why did you let this happen on your watch? Why are you handing me this world that is so screwed up? Did that ever occur to you? Inez, did that ever occur?
Yeah, I mean, I think it was a balance. It came throughout many years, many different phases, until I kind of was able to balance it between learning more about how, especially like the United States, how we developed, and how in the very beginning, like the Industrial Revolution, people were really just trying to have a better life. But then I kind of kept going and I was like, all right, well, you guys had a good life and you still kept doing these things. So yeah, I definitely was angry, because I mean, you do come across people who are aware, but then you come across people who just don't care too at all about any impact they have or anything. Just that motto of, well, I'm not going to be here, so it won't be my problem. I could say those people still make me pretty mad, just because it's hard for me to grasp somebody who doesn't have a connection to the earth that they live on and that gives them so much, and how much this wonderful earth does for us that we have no clue about and take for granted. So yeah, it's a hard thing to balance at times.
Yeah, I remember a little personal aside. When I was in high school, and my father worked for Uniroyal in Naugatuck when it was still a functioning company back down in Naugatuck, making tires, which made Naugatuck stink like the devil. Anyway, his specialty was cable, wire and cable, the outside of insulation to a cable that goes into coal mines, of all things. And he would travel all over the country as a salesman selling this stuff to major corporations. And I get in these really heated, this was a time of my awakening as a young man and learning about the environment and what we were doing to it. And this was in the 70s, that's how old I am. And I would have these arguments with him about, what are you doing? You can't, coal is terrible and la, 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 la. And he would say, Jim, I'm feeding my family, and after that, I'll be dead, so it doesn't matter to me. He would actually say that. And his attitude was not uncommon for that generation. That post-World War II came back to, to work in industry and business, and money was king. And providing for your family was the thing that you did. And it didn't matter worth a damn what you chewed up in the process. And I'm being kind. They had issues. They had real issues. Well, Dorothy, how about you? Did any thoughts on that? Did you come to like resent the generation before you?
There was definitely a time when I was a little more angrier. Now I can sort of look and see. It's such a nuanced topic, right? There's so many issues and so many different factors that play into somebody's ability to put, whether it's like mental resources, financial resources, or their own like physical efforts into, you know, creating a better environment for future generations. But no, there's definitely one of my main motivations for majoring in psychology and an environmental topic in college was, I was like, I'm going to use my psychology skills to my benefit to like make people appreciate and understand and care about the environment. So
how'd that work out for you?
I was just gonna say, still working on that. I'm not sure it's
not done yet. I got that. Are you both like Connecticut natives or something? I mean, it doesn't really, I don't throw that out there as being like, that's a terrible thing if you're not. I'm just wondering, where are your roots? Are you both from Connecticut?
Most of my family lives in Connecticut. I mean, actually, all of my immediate family lives in Connecticut. So, yeah, I've been here my whole life, and I don't know if I will ever leave, but we'll see.
Okay. You too, Dorothy? Yes.
Well. Yeah. Yep, me as well. I've been in Connecticut. My father's side has been in Connecticut for 3 generations. So.
See, I'm a transplant. I was born in New Jersey. Exit 8. And I grew up there thinking it was great. I loved it because you could bicycle everywhere. You know, there weren't any mountains or something. And the things were like in your neighborhood. You walk to them. And we moved to Connecticut when I was a freshman in high school. And it was like, oh, this is weird, man. There are trees and hills and everything is miles away. And you gotta drive everywhere to get someplace. And That was hard to get used to. I think I got used to it. I came to appreciate it more. But yeah, the transplant was very different from the New Jersey scene I had grown up in. That's for sure. Let me ask you, Inez, what was your time at Deep like? What did you do there? Because you know, our boss worked at Deep too.
Yeah, so. I did so much at Deep. I am so grateful for that experience and how much I learned, being able to see what happens from a state office perspective when it comes to environmental things was super cool.
Yeah.
But yeah, I did so much. I mean, I did like minuscule things, like I worked on office web pages and updated things for them. But then I was also able to do some really cool stuff. Like I was able to analyze how this office resupply center they had, how it reduced the office's annual greenhouse gas emissions using the EPA WARM model. That was cool. I was able to be a part of the SEPA scoping notice letters, which is the Connecticut Environmental Policy Act. And I learned a lot. It was really cool. It was a really cool office, a close-knit group of people. And yeah, it was great.
Now, this was an internship?
Yes.
And so did you get college credit for this?
I did. Okay. Luckily, I was there. I originally was there only for the fall. And then they invited me to stay through the spring semester as well. And I was happy to. And I was able to get it as college internship credits. And then I did an independent study the second semester because I couldn't repeat credits. But I really needed the credits to keep going because balancing an internship and school and then a regular job and then a regular life. It's a lot, but it worked out to my advantage.
Now, did they pay you? This was paid.
This was an unpaid internship, which is why I needed the college credits because I was still doing working regular at home away from school. And I needed to do a minimum of 8 hours to keep my internship. And I was commuting to New Haven. So it was a lot. So if I couldn't have gotten the college credits, I wasn't going to be able to continue through the spring. Sure. But I was really lucky enough to find a way to finagle the system a little bit of the university. And I was able to stay.
Well, hell, if they're not going to pay you, the least they could do is give you some college credit. Yeah. Something. I didn't even think they had unpaid internships anymore. That's still a thing. Yeah. Huh? Wow. Mm-hmm. Wow.
Holy I know. America. I was very surprised too, but I was really, I don't want to say desperate, but I really wanted an internship in the environmental field, especially. I've always really wanted to work with like in the government side. So when I saw that, I applied for it and I was like, well, I knew it was unpaid going into it, but I knew it would be something that would really stand out on my resume. So I was like, okay, I can do 8 hours unpaid a week. Yeah. And one day I'll just keep my fingers crossed that this will pay off. And it did.
Yeah. Yeah. No, I mean, those things do pay off. I mean, when I was in high school, I went to my local Congressman Saracen. He's no longer, he was a congressman in Waterbury area. And I walked into his office and said, I want to intern. And they didn't know what they didn't turn me away. So I just kept showing up. And one thing led to another. And by the time I went to college, I went to Lowell Weicker's office in the Senate. I don't know if you guys know about Lowell Weicker, but he was governor. He did lots of stuff. He was quite a guy. And he was a senator at the time. And he took good care of me. He really did. It was all unpaid, but it was the education of a lifetime. And then I told him I needed money. I needed to get a real job. So you know where he found me a job? You're going to love this. At the Republican National Committee. At the RNC in Washington, D.C. And that, let me tell you, folks, that was a liberal education right there. Anyway, paid money. Dorothy, you did a sustainability review at UConn's Avery Point campus, right?
Yep.
So what was that about? How was that process? And did it result in any, I don't know, substantive changes or improvements or anything on campus?
So we built the sustainability review sort of modeling the STARS report that a lot of universities, including UConn, does. But we wanted to do a specific report for the Avery Point campus because UConn is such a large university with so many moving parts. One campus can look very different from the other. So we wanted to do one specifically focused on Avery Point. And you know, we started out with the intention of like collecting a lot of data and having it be very similar to the STARS reporting system. But it turns out there wasn't a ton of that data readily available. So if anything, the biggest thing I learned was that sustainability initiatives and progress are really, really long, long game. So you have to just kind of dive in and figure out where's the information that you need. How can you get that information? And then how can you build on that information over time? So we ended up, instead of having a more data-based report, which is what we had originally intended, we ended up having just more of a narrative, illustrative report that describes the sustainability initiatives and programs that we already had on campus, and then found some weak spots of one where we could collect data, and two, just some areas where we could expand programs or there was some untapped potential there. And then out of that, we sort of used that to inform a grant that we applied for with STARS to get some renewable energy education stuff happening on campus. And that sort of was like my last hurrah as president. And I left before I graduated before they finished that project, but it's finished now. So if you go to the Avery Point campus, there is solar panels and a small wind turbine.
Oh, great.
Near the boating shed as like a renewable energy education opportunity.
Yeah, I did a lot of sustainability work with the sustainability group at the UMass campus in Amherst. And when you talk about that long game, the dynamics around this have changed a little bit over the years. Maybe you noticed it or were part of it as it changed because, you know, 10 years ago, nobody even had a sustainability committee on campuses, state universities, and it was always treated with this, oh, yeah, sure, okay, whatever, you know, don't be so irritating, go away. And then it became, you know, no, the governor is pushing this. The state legislature is demanding this. The trustees of the university are saying, you're not doing enough. And so the dynamics changed and the demand for it changed. And then it was suddenly like playing catch up. Well, all right, now we have to do a bunch of stuff. We got to get solar panels on the roofs. And they discovered the roofs couldn't support solar panels. So then they had to do all sorts of other stuff, you know.
Yeah.
But that whole long game notion got in the way and is still getting in the way, I think, I'm asking you, of the immediate need and demand. I mean, this is no longer a thing we can think about 30 years from now. we got to think about this yesterday. We got to do this now. And I don't know if the university systems, with all their bureaucracy and their, you know, their evolutionary thinking and all of the, you know, the long game attitude, are really up to this task. How do you feel about that?
Yeah, I mean, I will say, like, my experience is just to UConn, and UConn is very aggressive with their sustainability efforts. Yeah. So that's great. And also the Avery Point campus is like the home of the marine science program. So there was already, you're totally right about, if there's not an energy behind the, like, the long game, and people are just kind of blasé about it and letting it sort of run its course, then that's certainly a problem. Fortunately, at UConn, there is a lot of energy behind all these programs, and people really want them to happen. There's a lot of top-down support for these sorts of programs, which is great. But yeah, I will say the bureaucracy, just navigating like university relationships and stuff, especially at such a large university, was one of the biggest challenges of. Yeah. Even though
I found
support.
That constantly infuriating, the hierarchy, the whole like concept of a collegial mentality meant very different things to different people. It was, you know, I'm in charge of my own little piece of turf, and I'm the emperor of ice cream over here, and you gotta it's all the politics involved, is sometimes incredible. But it is a whole lot better now, more urgent than it was, like I said, just 10 years ago or so. I mean, people now get it. Their campuses now, the goal, of course, is to try to be energy independent, literally, to be carbon free. You know, 10 years ago would have been like, what? No, no, don't even go there. That's not going to happen. You know, that's a pipe dream. So at least there's some evolution in the thought process. I don't know if it's too late or not. It's arguable. Inez, speaking of carbon free, Inez, talk to me about carbon pricing, because this fascinates me about what it's all about. Why is it something we should pursue? And from my understanding of the political situation around carbon pricing, it's almost impossible to get people in mixed company to agree to do it.
It's a very interesting topic. So when I did a research proposal, so I was proposing research to be done on the effectiveness of carbon pricing policies, specifically rigorous and non-rigorous approaches. So I wanted to see, were these more rigorous approaches making more of an impact in reducing annual greenhouse gas emissions than these non-rigorous approaches? And it's interesting because there's not much of a difference, just because the way that carbon pricing policies are set up. So I think they're great, and they are very promising for the future in terms of a policy approach towards mitigating the impacts of climate change and trying to reduce these impacts. But there's such a big problem, because the biggest approach that's taken nationally, internationally, regionally, is these cap and trade and trading emissions, these schemes. It's so hard because you end up at a level where you're not reducing emissions, you're just staying at a standstill. So if a corporation
at best
doesn't hit their cap of the emissions that they're allotted to use, they can sell those off to another company instead of just taking the win of having reduced emissions. So either way, you're having the emissions, they're still emitting either way. Carbon taxes are a bit different. Those have been found to be a little more effective, because you're actually putting financial penalties and incentives on reducing emissions, but it's hard to implement them because nobody wants the extra tax. I mean, there's no form of, I mean, and you could ask anybody, no matter what they believe. I mean, usually most people, the common person, doesn't want to forefront another tax for an international impact that might help in the future reduce emissions just a bit. So it's such a hard topic, especially when emissions and climate change is such a political thing. It's not seen just like as a solution for everybody. It's like, is it a right thing? Is it a left thing? It's so much more than it needs to be, that it's hard for it to be even looked at with an unbiased lens.
Yeah. And the whole cap and trade, do we trust but verify? I don't trust big business to be able to actually tell me, or for that matter, what are the trading system is based on. There's so many, I don't know what you would call it, sleight of hand. and make-believe stuff in the trade system that it's hard to go for. So, and I agree with you. You take something as politically charged as global warming, shouldn't be, but let's say it is still very much so politically charged in some areas. And then you mix that up with raising taxes.
Yeah.
Yeah. The well, you know.
Storm. Yep.
So it's almost an impossible. Do you know of any municipality, any level of government, national or international, that has actually successfully implemented this?
Successfully? That's a hard thing to say. When I was comparing them, I focused on Canada and the U.S. because Canada was found to be some of the most rigorous policies. In the U.S., I used as, unfortunately, the least rigorous policies. And the only thing the United States has right now is the Regional Greenhouse Gas Initiative, which is, like it says, it's regional. So there's certain states that are signed into this to have this cap and trade scheme. Connecticut is actually signed into it, but that was a big thing in my research too, was how do you determine if these are effective or not with all the outside factors that come into play? And when it's a regional scheme like the U.S. has, you could see that Connecticut, for example, would have reduced emissions, but then Massachusetts, if they're not signed on, their emissions start to increase. So you can put these into place, but you can't stop corporations from going outside of these regional territories to do their dirty work,
whatever they like, or yeah,
and exactly. To meet their quota. Yeah, exactly. So it's a big gap in the literature that I found, is nobody knows how to really determine when these policies are being effective. Internationally, I think they were found to be like 0-2% effective in reducing annual emissions. It's such a hard topic to study and to really get hard facts on.
And regionally, it's insane. I mean, as recently has been demonstrated, our air comes from Quebec sometimes in ways we don't want it to. And Ohio, the weather patterns alone will make the regional application of some of these things rather absurd. Politically more feasible, maybe, but in terms of the science, almost absurd. Neglected to ask both of you, and I do want to ask before the break, what drew you to sustainable CT? Dorothy, what other than, and you can be honest here, is it like, you know, because it's a job? And that's valid. It's a valid reason. Like, it's a job in a field that you're interested in. I mean, what brought you to sustainable CT?
Part of it is definitely, it was a nonprofit that was actually in a field of my interest, which is really exciting. Yeah. I have a history of working in education nonprofits, or just in education in like the public school systems, and I enjoy it, but that was not ever my intention for my career path. And it kind of just sort of, I got on that train and I wanted to get off. So that was part of it. But sustainable CT definitely piqued my interest, mostly because it played directly into my sustainability review of the Avery Point campus, just being on the flip side of being someone who's trying to fill out a certification report and dealing with the trouble of like, how do I find this information? How can I make whatever entity, in my case, it was a university, in sustainable CT's case, it's a municipality, but how can we make these entities more sustainable? So it was really interesting, and I was excited about being on the other side too, of maybe helping towns become more sustainable, and even just learning about, even just in the first few weeks of this, of working here, of learning about all the programs going on in Connecticut has been really exciting and uplifting for me. So yeah, that was part of it, definitely it being in the field, and then my familiarity with the general concept.
Yeah, you know what's really cool, once you've been here a little while and gotten to meet a lot of these municipal actors, what's really was astonishing to me was how hard people are working, how much they believe in this. There are people very dedicated to what they're doing, which you may not find in a lot of other jobs and industries. They're there to get paid and yada, yada. That's on that. And again, that is valid. We all have to eat. But I kept running into people whose heart and soul were really into this. And that, and to me, as an old skeptic, it was very reassuring to meet these kind of people and know that, you know, this was not just selling widgets. It's not, you know, this is something that is existential to who they are and what they, what they're trying to accomplish for their themselves and for their kids and their communities. Inez, how about you? What did sustainable CT mean to you when this opportunity came?
I think it's actually such a funny story, because when I was in my last semester of college, I knew I wanted to do something where I could continue being somebody who supported the environment and sustainability. But I also wanted to be in with the government of some sort, working with like some sort of government stance where I could be making a physical change that I could see. But I didn't want to be a politician or really in with the government, because I didn't want to get into the weeds of that. And my last criteria was that I love working on a local standpoint. So I love seeing people, teaching people, and helping them really understand sustainability. So the job opening was forwarded to me by one of my coworkers at Deep when I was there. And I remember reading the responsibility.
You could do this for money.
Yeah. And I was reading it and I was like, there's no way that this is real. Like, that's everything I was looking for. I was like, this is so crazy. So it was honestly just such a great opportunity that fell into my lap, even just applying and getting to meet everybody and learning about the organization in itself. I was like, wow, things like this really do exist out there, because I was under the perception that my job criteria was going to lead me somewhere not successful. Like, I was like, there's no way I'm going to have all these boxes checked fresh out of college, but it worked out perfectly. So
great. Yeah. And we're such good people.
Yeah.
We're nice people. I mean, Jess is a great person to work with. And as I'm sure you've discovered, she's very smart, very personable. So, I mean, and so this small group of people, we kind of, you know, punch above our weight as best we can. We're doing a lot with a small group of people, and it feels good. It feels good. And as somebody who, you know, came through marketing and political communications and working in campaigns, stuff like that, this to me is very nice, because it's not like trying to, you know, sell the paint off the side of a house anymore. It's really selling things. It's not even a sell. It's true communication of stuff that we believe in. I mean, what a concept. So it's been very nice for me. Let's take a break for a few minutes, and we'll sell some widgets, and we'll come back and have loads of fun, all tan dressed and ready. Be right back. We'll return to our program in just a moment. You've been listening to The Impact, a Sustainable CT podcast. Hey, while you're out there tripping the web fantastic, don't forget to join us on Facebook for some fun and interesting stuff. Guaranteed safe for children and pets. Come on, be our friend, won't you? At facebook.com/sustainableCT. Twitter, too, while it lasts. Follow us on twitter.com/sustainableCT. And yes, of course, we're LinkedIn. Search for Sustainable CT from your LinkedIn page, and you'll find us right there, being all LinkedIn and media social. And if you're not yet a subscriber to Actions and Impact, the Sustainable CT newsletter, you could be missing out on some very important information to you, to your organization, and to your town. Accept no substitutes. Do yourself a favor and subscribe today. And you can do that where? At sustainablect.org, of course. Let's get back to the program. Welcome back, everyone. We are having a wonderful time here in the studio, talking to Inez and Dorothy, who are recently joined Sustainable CT. And we are very glad to have them, and they're smart and energetic. And this is why this is fascinating to me is, quite honestly, candidly, from a generational point of view, a lot of people in my generation are still in control of things. We built it, we broke it, and we still own it. And we're still in charge of so many things. And I don't like necessarily the way we've left it, or that we will leave it. And so I'm increasingly interested in looking back to this next generation coming up, asking how you feel about this stuff, where you're going with it, where do you want to end up? So just to get us into this idea, what are your career goals in this? Maybe Dorothy, you could tell me, do you have a personal career goal in sustainability, short term, long term? What are you looking to do here?
Yeah, so I mean, my background is in ecology and evolutionary biology, so there is an element of I do enjoy working like more directly with species or land management, things of that nature. But I mean, that plays directly into sustainability and climate change, because biodiversity and land management and species management are all things that are directly affected by climate change and sustainability. So yeah, in an ideal world, continue working. I enjoy working in the nonprofit sector. That's why I always end up here.
You're not going to be a millionaire, you know.
No. Giving that up. That's okay. So yeah, working in the nonprofit sector, doing some sort of conservation, sustainability related work. And then I also, you know, growing up on a farm, and my partner's a vegetable farmer, and I have a strong desire to have a vegetable farm at some point as well. I think that would be really fun. I think access to fresh food and equity to, you know, food justice is a really important and interesting topic, and not one that necessarily comes to mind immediately when people think about climate issues, but it's something that's near and dear to me. So yeah,
and very important. I mean,
okay. That's my loose career path.
Inez, where do you see yourself in 20 years?
I see myself wherever the wind takes me. I don't have any plan or end of the line goal. I would just really like to keep being at this place where I can see physical changes that I'm making in one way or another, whether that's teaching people about sustainability, whether that's being hands-on in a town municipal government, working there, whether that's working for the state. I would really, in a perfect world, I would love to be somebody who influences policy and works on policy and writes policy from an unbiased lens, but it's a very perfect world that I'm describing, to be able to get into the politics of it without having being lobbied and all the other fun stuff that comes with it. But I just would love to make a change in communities. I'm a little more realistic these days. If you asked me this 5 years ago, I might have said that I wanted to be president so I could make everybody believe in climate change and have metal straws. But I'm a little more realistic these days. So any change I can make, I'll be happy with.
Well, don't give up on the big dream, you know. You know, he's got to grow a little thicker skin to be able to put up with the you know, the nonsense along the way. You know, in 40 to 45 years or so, when you're both essentially my age, what a concept that is, the world will look like a very different place, and it will be either very different better or very different worse. I don't know if there's going to be a whole lot in between, but you can imagine that spectrum. And it really depends on what we do now, really, within the next 10 years, how that next 48, 50 is going to look like. You know, how much faith do you have in humans at this point in our political will and ability to affect change? And you're the generation with the most to gain or lose here. You know, that old yarn, not to put too fine a spin on it, is we won't be around. I won't be around in 50 years to say, oh, gee, I wish I hadn't done that, or I wish I had done more or something. It's going to be what it is. And you're going to inherit that. And I want you to tell me what you think, given this rather bleak scenario I'm outlining here, I think reality, what you think our priorities should be. What do we really need to do first and most and hardest, or what do we need to do really to affect change in the next 10 years so that the next 50 are a lot brighter than they might otherwise be? Who wants to pick that up? Dorothy, why don't you?
Okay. Yeah, that's a big question. I mean, obviously the climate crisis is the most important issue, I would think, in my opinion, that we have to tackle, because everything's sort of, it's like dominoes. It's kind of going to, the climate crisis will kind of start setting off all these, already has started setting off all these dominoes. Reducing, you know, carbon emissions and implementing policy that gets behind that idea and supports that direction, because in renewable energy, because like that's sort of our only option, right? So
is it possible?
Yeah, I was gonna say I'm an optimist. I'm a climate optimist. I like to imagine that yes, and I think even in my lifetime, I've seen climate change deniers become less and less of a mainstream idea and concept, right? So, and there is research to support that over time, even in like the last decade, that there's been a significant shift between people who didn't necessarily believe in climate change. Now they do agree. They might not agree on what we should do to tackle climate change or potentially how urgent it is, but people do now, in general, the vast majority of people do believe in climate change, which is an important first step, right? But of course, that's the first step.
Let me challenge you just a little bit on this. Mm-hmm. And the reason I'm thinking it now, here in Connecticut, mm-hmm. yes,
yeah, where,
you know, people tend to get it. There's still pockets yeah. of resistance and kind of weirdness going on. But yeah. Connecticut, you know, and even for that matter, the rest of New England is pretty much hip to the whole thing. Mm-hmm. Not so much other places. There are places in this country where it is still a really scary proposition. And more. And then I'll take it even a step further. The difficulty becomes, because yeah, I agree with you. What's the urgent need? The scientific urgent need, no discussion, got to go to renewable energy. All well and good to say that. The problem is you have a developing and underdeveloped world that has missed out on the party because yeah. we took all the punch after World Absolutely. War II and we had our time in the sun. I'm mixing my metaphors here. All right. And, you know, now you've got Africa, Asia, much of Latin America. You've got most of the world, frankly, that yeah. isn't us saying, Absolutely. All right, where's our time? Where's mm-hmm. our, where do we, how do we fit into this now reduced expectations? And my argument has always been, well, we have to figure out a way that we're not reducing expectations. We're advancing and creating wealth and expectations and greater, better living standards while reducing our carbon footprint. Because if you can't do both of those at the same time, yeah. you don't have a chance in hell. Because yeah. the rest of the world isn't going to follow you, no matter how much the science demands it. Mm-hmm. Right? I mean, that's...
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, it's a problem that we benefited. We had all the economic and industrial benefits of using fossil fuels to our great advantage. And now we've created a problem that now the entire world is stuck with. And there's the coupled issue of saying, well, now you really shouldn't be using all yeah. these fossil fuels to spur your industrial and economic development. And
don't do what we did.
Exactly. Right. And that's unfair, right? Because that leaves people in the lurch of economic, a traditional path of economic and industrial development. So yeah, it's a really, the international implications of climate change are very complex and yeah, rooted in really unfair imperialistic colonial ramifications. So
it's a tough nut to crack. That's the conundrum is a political one, not mm-hmm. a scientific one to me.
Yeah.
I may not, you know, to me, it's a political problem and finding political will and common cause to be able to do the things that we need to do. And you coming with a psychological background, what is human behavior? What does the human species want on yeah. that rudimentary level? And are there commonalities enough that we can meet somewhere to be able to satisfy those? We all want, you know, but better for our kids or clean air or clean water. There's certain things we need and want as a species, let alone as an American or as a citizen of Connecticut. Inez, your thoughts on this?
Yeah, I mean, to your initial question on like the forefront of what we need to be looking at, I think I've always had an interest in people, groups of people. And I think if we could all kind of just find that common ground again of us all just being people on a planet that supports us and taking away the politics and the fear and the all the crazy stuff that comes along with it. And I mean, really just the values of life, too. I mean, that's a lot of the downfall that's gotten us here, too, is this. I wouldn't just say American, but it's a very American materialistic value on these extravagant lifestyles and these things that we think that we need. I mean, going back to our roots in that. The way people used to live off of land and value land and how cool those cultures can be, it really puts into perspective what us humans need to survive. And it's nothing. It's food, water, the sun, all these natural things. And everything else is really just like the cherry on top, but really just finding the limits and trying to respect those boundaries instead of making them personal as if some politics are trying to take things away from you. And I mean, going to your other point with developing countries, I mean, that's an even harder consideration, because if you look at historical emissions, yeah, America and these big developed countries have the biggest historical emissions. So in a perfect world, we would stop emitting anything tomorrow just so these other countries could catch up at the very least. But even then, like Dorothy said, the impacts of climate change aren't linear either. Unfortunately, these less developed nations are going to take the brunt of the impacts too, which discourages big developing developed countries to stop emitting even less. I mean, we're not feeling the impacts the way that these coastal islands and small islands are feeling it. So, I mean, until it hits us in the face, it's really hard to encourage people who don't believe in it to at least just to consider it, not even to change anything, but just to consider that it will happen, not that it could happen, but that we're at the point that it will happen.
Yeah. You got to wonder, I mean, as the fires and the floods and the blizzards and the droughts continue to worsen, and everyone becomes, you know, more familiar and experiences that, even in our country. Right. I mean, Quebec was on fire. It still is. And we've experienced that. You think there would be some evolution of the mindset to be able to really, you know, you could ignore this for only so long in our pristine suburban neighborhoods. But then when it comes home to roost, that it have a different attitude, different perspective. And all the science that I've been reading of late is telling me that the temperatures are going to continue to rise. I mean, if we stop today. Right. We stop today and we don't have any more carbon entering the atmosphere. That 1.5 degree is coming anyway at this point. We're kind of like past that tipping point now. And to my way of thinking, it's well, if that's so, when do we start saying to ourselves, all right, we need to put more emphasis on how are we going to adapt to this new reality? And at the same time, it makes me feel queasy that sounds like giving up. I mean, I understand we need to keep, you know, reducing carbon, getting it out of the atmosphere. That's all well and good, but we're going to have to live with a new reality. Is there any thought about that? How do you see our future in that respect?
Yeah, I mean, it's a hard thing to face, but it is. I mean, regardless of what happens tomorrow or 20 years, adapting is going to be the biggest thing to have to do. And I mean, not even as in losing faith, but almost also shifting what we need to protect and focus on. So, I mean, adapting doesn't mean always that we need to wrap our house in a big bubble because we're scared of the bad air. Maybe it could be, okay, let's shift from this if this isn't working at a national point to maybe let's focus on protecting our oceans because our oceans are the biggest carbon sink that we have. So maybe let's make sure that if they're not going to reduce the carbon emissions, that they're not going to go for our oceans now, which are absorbing most of this carbon that they're emitting, or figuring out ways so communities that are already impoverished and maybe suffering aren't going to suffer even worse from climate change. And these affluent, very wealthy communities will never face any of it. I mean, it's a hard balance. And then we have little things too, especially here in Connecticut. I mean, everybody thinks it's so weird. Like, you hear so many people talking about the weather. And I mean, our weather is a month behind. And everybody thinks it's just like, oh, it's just a wet and cool summer. But it's like, when you really look into it, it's climate change. It's the climate changing. And it's going to be the new normal next year. But it's so easy to write off that it's just a weird thing happening.
Yeah. Dorothy, what's your take?
Yeah, like Anna said, we're going to shift from, you know, maybe we can stop or go back, reverse climate change or whatever. Obviously, we're past that point. It's more of like a mitigation and adaptation perspective that we have to have at this point. Yeah, like Anna said, mitigating, you know, the effects of the most vulnerable communities should definitely be a high priority, and identifying areas that will have the most impact on trying to steer us away from an even worst case scenario, right? But I will say, you know, again, as an evolutionary biologist at heart, I do remain optimistic in that, like, one, for one, the human species is an incredibly adaptable species. more so than any other species. That's how we've gotten here, to our detriment, but it can be to our benefit. And also, you know, species can't necessarily keep up at the same rate in which we can, but many species are already adapting to climate change, and there is hope. That's what I always tell myself.
We're the cockroaches of the universe. We'll figure out a way to
remain. Oh, we'll probably survive. And, you know, and at the end of the day, the Earth, you know, has gone through many iterations. I mean, this is a way zoomed out perspective, which doesn't actually help the actual daily lives of people who are suffering from the effects of climate change.
Yeah.
But the overall humanity perspective is that in the end, you know, the Earth and all of its species and all of its goodness is adaptable, and I do have hope. But we do need to focus where we're going to mitigate and what will have the biggest impacts on writing the course, for sure.
Well, that's an optimistic note on which we will end, because we're out of time, believe it or not. It just zoomed right by. How about that? And it is optimistic, I think. We'll follow that up again someday with another conversation.
Yeah, I could be wrong, which would be sad, but...
That's all right. Thank you both so much for doing this. I really do appreciate it, and I hope we can continue the conversation at some point in the near future. So thank you.
Awesome. Thank you.
Thank you.
We hope you've enjoyed today's edition of The Impact, a Sustainable CT Podcast. This program is recorded, produced, and copyrighted, by Sustainable CT. Thank you for your interest. Thank you for listening. And thank you to our sponsor, the Common Sense Fund. Thanks again to Inez Ortiz and Dorothy Pizak for joining us and keeping it real. And thanks to everyone for taking local actions that have a statewide impact.